the other kinds of structures that flap would be sheets of feathers, sheets of integument. You can stretch an intestine until it's straight and then measure it that way. It turns into a cylinder. Cylinders are easy to put a coordinate system on once they're straight. It's difficult before they were straightened. And so you get to cheat in all of these useful ways.
I have a question.
You got your wisdom teeth, Joe?
Mostly not. I think none of them. I mean, I did have them.
You were born with them, but they have been removed later. Okay, the interesting thing about this machine is that it was only developed in the 1990s because the geometry of this linkage is hard to handle. So this is what's called a Panorex, and it was first marketed in 1992, which seems awfully recent for an adjunct to an operation that was being done 150 years ago.
So I have a question about landmarking for comparison between individuals, which is, it seems like it's really important where you decide to set your central landmark.
Oh, it is extremely important how you put the film down on the form. We had some hints about this yesterday when I was showing you, not the baby, but those figures from the archaeology, the anthropology textbook, which were very carefully put down on a mid-sagittal plane. So this is called norma lateralis. It's the center post here of that picture is straight through the ear holes between here and here. Straight. The central beam of the x-ray has to be here. And then there's a rotation component that is the line from here to here. And I was explaining to you yesterday that that's not a point, and that's not a point. They're just conventional. So the anthropologists are used to doing this, to picking up a skull and putting it into one of these six standard orientations. They're named in Latin, norma lateralis, that's this one, that's norma frontalis. Melvin Moss called them the six ladies of the anthropology lab, because norma's a woman's name. That's a joke. So we are used to standardizing images like this. One way of thinking about the Procrustes method is as a different kind of standardization. And one way of thinking about what I'm going to be talking about today, the analysis of three landmarks at a time, triangles, is a different particular standardization. For that is a function of the data, of the shape changes, rather than the apparent symmetries of the anatomy. But you are free to exploit that possibility any way you like, as trivially as when you pick up I'm blocking on the name of the species. It's one of my papers. These floating pick up an ammonite. It has a plane of symmetry, and it's obvious that you're going to look at it along that plane of symmetry or perpendicular to the plane of symmetry. It's just obvious. You don't even have to say so. Peter Ward here studies ammonites, and of course that's how he looks at them. It isn't even computed. It's done usually by eye, very, very accurately. Because this is something we humans do very well by eye, lining up the middle of a symmetric form. It's how we look at faces.
It doesn't seem like humans would be great at trying to figure out where the center point in a cylinder wrap of a face would be.
Okay, well, that's actually interesting, because you can do it easily in this posture, and it's damn near impossible to do it in this posture. We do it for vertical lines, and we do not do it for horizontal lines. It's hard for you to find the center line of my—I think I'm 90 degrees over. That's what I'm trying to do. Hard to find the center line of my face when it's this way on a screen. Very easy when it's this way.
So, but what about the center line through that is the center of the cylinder, which is the right?
That's not intuitively accessible because we're not really that close to cylinders. That has to be done by some sort of numerical integration. Eggs, bird's eggs, are usually rotationally symmetric, but they're not ellipses. They're not ellipsoids. they're kind of lumpy cubic curves. But the fact that they're rotationally symmetric is kind of obvious to anybody. And so you don't try to put an egg down facing forward. You just try to put it down facing upward. And it's not that hard for humans. I guess for other primates as well.
I think chimpanzees can do that, some kinds of monkeys.
Okay, we didn't quite finish yesterday. We got to about to here.
I think you should center it on the screen.
Oh, that's a good idea. So it's talking about symmetry as we were. Okay. And I was here on page 35 of chapter 5. That was 35. After looking at lists of indexes for, again, some of the classic anthropology, multi-species anthropology of the early 20th century, and the problem of selecting what it is you want to use as your proportions, your angles, your distance ratios, your distances, is a perfectly general one. So I've here assembled some figures from earlier in the course that lead up to those figures on page 35 and 37, and then will lead up in turn to all of the, I'm going to call it, correct analyses that will follow, the ones that aren't arbitrary. You remember, this is the data structure we're looking at. It's just 8 points on the neurocranium of a rat skull in the mid-sagittal plane, the plane of symmetry. And you can actually see this on a lateral x-ray of the rat, x-ray through with central beam down the rat's own two ear holes, because each of these turns out to look like a little squiggle on the x-ray. You can see it as an open, as a suture, a line here. This is the end of a curve, a little gap, tooth, that's obvious.
You're talking about the points along the top curve, right? You're talking about the points along the top curve.
I was here. I'm sorry. I was on my own screen, wasn't I? That was silly. Yeah. This is a gap between two bones. So we're in cartilage. That's rather more arbitrary. This is the end of a curve, like the bobby pin. The other bobby pin. This is a suture. And there's lots more stuff up here, but this is the one we're using.
And in SES there,
so sphenoethmoid synchondrosis.
Well, fine, but is the point put in the middle of the gap?
The point is put wherever Melvin Moss said, and I think the artist decided to put it halfway between there and there. I don't know exactly where the point was because I don't have the X-rays, but it was digitized by the dean of dentistry at Columbia, Melvin Moss, and so I trust him. There is a craft to this task, which only now, in the 21st century, is being done better by computers. Machine learning can do this better now than we could 50 years ago, 30 years ago, but this data is 35 years old. So it was digitized by hand. 1981, I think. Okay, so we have many possibilities, and the point of this part of the lecture is just that there a lot of these possibilities, and we need some guidance. So most of these are figures you've seen at least once before. Here's all the distances. For 8 points, there are 28 distances. The data set has, in this case, 18 rats times 8 different ages. So each of these little plots has 144 points on it, 18 polygons of 8 points. And you can see they're differently shaped. Some are convex upward, some are convex downward, some are kind of cubic-ish, some are sort of linear. It's not obvious how you effectively summarize this in order to say something intelligent about the rats.
So this case, the distances, I don't get what this plot really is showing us.
Each at this point, should say, it's landmark 1 to 2. You don't know how they're numbered, but this happens to be 1, this happens to be 2.
Okay, so it's a distance.
This distance
As a function of something called size.
The function of size, which we're going to get to in a minute.
Yeah.
For 18 animals over 8 ages. And okay. Each animal is one of these lots.
And each of those little things where we see a little rectangle with a smudge on it is actually a bunch of points.
Yeah. And we'll blow it up in a bit.
Yeah.
But the point I'll be making is we need statistical methods to handle this. Next Tuesday, and also 2 weeks from Tuesday, will be the two lectures about the multivariate machinery we're going to be taking advantage of. But it still won't be obvious how you put this sort of thing together, even for 8 landmarks. Later today, pretty soon in fact, we'll be starting with just 3 landmarks, which is feasible for understanding the general idea of one of these descriptors, uniform changes. Okay, so this is the problem, and there are a diversity of possible solutions. For instance, we could just decide we wanted to measure area here. We still have the problem of a time scale, because growth isn't uniform. And here are 4 different ways of representing how area changes. Here it's just these area class, the rats went from the first age to the 8th age. Notice that they're kind of tapering off here as they go. This is, again, all the data. Here, I took the log of age, so these become a little further apart, these become a little closer together. It's a little closer to linear. Here, which is what I was doing over on this chart as well, I just, using a technique called alternating scaling, I let age be defined as the average of these, in effect, pretty close to the mean size, so that I have some function of that, I've forgotten what, so that these curves on the average are straight lines. That turns out to be useful. You can then connect up the points to get a curve like that. And if your interest is in individual persistence, large animals staying large or not, small animals staying small or not, we talked about this a little 2 weeks ago. If you take the residuals from these curves, you get a very useful set of plots. But what we just did was decide we wanted to talk about residuals of size. And there's a lot more to the world of biology. We'll see it very soon in today's lecture. There's a lot more information here than just size. And we need tools for calling it to our attention. So there's nothing wrong with this plot, except it's just about size. It's, in my opinion, better than all of those. But they're still just about size. This is, in effect, the summary of all 28 of these. In terms of total area. I showed you also a couple of weeks ago a curve that said, well, how about if you, is it this one? Yeah. How about if I just decide which 2 length measures are the best 2 for predicting that area? That's a different question, somewhat more biological, using the tools we had in Chapter 3, because these are now multiple regressions, 2 predictors. And we get an interesting figure here that will turn out to be very closely related to what we're going to be doing in about 10 pages. That we get a best predictor of this area, R is 0.9983, from a pair of distances that are almost at 90 degrees. And that is not going to be an accident. But the predictor weights these differences differently. This one, the horizontal, has much higher weight, 1.06, than this one, the vertical, which is 0.85. And already, there's a very strong hint here of something that's going to be very important throughout the rest of the course. These analyses are about spaces of possible measurements. So this is a figure about, wherever it went, about a space of possible variables. Not all the possible variables. We'll see almost immediately there are lots more variables than this. There's a double infinity of them, actually. But the sorting of the variables is going to be as important as the sorting of the cases. This is sorting of the variables by picking just two of them. And a technique you've probably seen before, principal components analysis, does the same thing by sorting all 28 according to a different sort of hypothesis. Back here, we were predicting size. This is a quantity we decided on in advance. Over here, this is a slide from chapter 4, so we'll be doing this either next Tuesday or 2 weeks from Tuesday. We're taking all 28 variables and instead just describing their covariance pattern among themselves. So there are 28 numbers here. And we come out at the end with what's called a biplot. These are the scores for the individuals. This is 18 curves with 8 points each on principal component 1 against principal component 2. It's almost but not quite straight. These are the big ones, these are the small ones, these are the young ones, these are the old ones. And at the same time, you get this picture here of what are usually called principal component loadings. And printed in large type here is a different kind of biological signal, namely the list of variables, distance measures, along the baseline here, the cranial baseline. That's called the cranial base, if you're doing mammal skulls. There are six of these distances, 1 to 2, 1 to 3, 1 to 4, 2 to 3, 2 to 4, 3 to 4. And these six are the six that show the highest correlations with size, because that's what this dimension is. It's the correlation with the first principal component. This turned out to be size, but this plot wasn't the same kind of thinking as this plot. Here, we're saying there appears to be a pattern whereby the bigger animals, sorry, that was off the screen, wasn't it? Whereby the bigger animals have disproportionately bigger cranial bases. This phenomenon has a name. It's called orthocephalization. And it's telling you something about the rats, not about the data. So what I'm trying to show you is, by being a biologist, you get to look at these patterns in two different ways at the same time. One is a pattern of something that your numbers are doing. And here, your numbers are pretty much saying you have one dimension with a lot of variance and another dimension with just a little bit of variance, kind of common between the animals. But the other way of talking about it says, looking at these numbers and other pictures we'll be getting later, and by the way, the phenomenon you got there is much greater growth along this direction than along this direction, along any other direction, in fact. Okay, let's try to make some use of that. And again, in this full system of 8 landmarks, which is included, that we can use this in practice for hundreds of landmarks at the same time. So 8 isn't really very many, but 8 is too many for the biologist alone to cope with, unless they're highly organized. So now turn back to page 34, I think it is. No, make that 35. And here are four of 28 possible pictures that are now age against age for 28 pairs of ages. There were eight original ages, and so there are 28 pairs. Here's the youngest to the second youngest. Here's the youngest to the oldest. Here's the youngest to the one in the middle, and here's the one in the middle to the oldest. And what I've done here is given you another image that's not satisfactory as a biological summary. Let's zoom in. There we go. This is called a Euclidean distance matrix analysis, and I don't like it, but the fact that I don't like it isn't relevant at the moment. It's that what it's doing here is saying, from age 7 to 14 days, there are a lot of different growth rates, and some are big, like 1.427 here, and some are small, like 1.141 and 1.91. And it would be nice to know which of these were biggest, which of these are smallest. We can say that. We can find that. It would even be nicer to put this into some geometrical organization. And it turns out this is very close to a simple grid. Where is it now? Catch up ahead. Find that general picture. Which is that. Sorry. I was in the wrong chat. That's why I can't find it. Okay, that. So, look at that picture. Try to make sense of it. And now I'm just going to skip ahead to page 136 and show you the same data. Of course, getting to page 136 is not that easy. Same analysis. No, I'm not. That's not page 136.
I think you typed the wrong number up into there.
I'm off by one page. That's what I did. Okay. This is the same data. Now, if you're a biologist, if you're a statistician, I just told you everything you need to know. That's the same data. The information content of this picture is the same as the information content of that frame we were blowing up here. Take my word for it, or if you doubt, you're looking kind of puzzled. It's Kugler, okay. Right?
Yeah.
No, okay. So, take my word for it. This is, in fact, the same statistical information. Same count of degrees of freedom. There are 13 of them. But boy, this is easier to understand because it's so close to a describable biologizable phenomenon that we've called the uniform component, and we'll get to in 15 or 20 minutes. This picture, as I say, is the same information that we had 100 pages earlier, where it was certainly not obvious that we were trending over it. Wrong direction, here we go. Yeah. That this is so simple is not patent from this view. And I'm kind of raising the issue that you will need the help of tools, which we're giving you, to find simple structure in data sets like this where the structure is simple. Why you want simple structure is that's how you talk to your classmates about it. That's how you talk to your colleagues, to the people at your national meetings, to the students when you end up teaching biology, and so on. So this is a lousy analysis of a simple phenomenon. We have the tools to produce the better pictures of the same data.
Yeah. On this one, the points you put there are some sort of average locations of those points.
And the numbers are...
The lines have been drawn between, and then you put numbers on the line.
Now, the growth ratios.
You are, I think, saying that those grids you just showed us are not approximate fits in some sense. They are... exactly represent this collection of numbers. Is that true?
Yes, the grids exactly represent this collection of numbers because this collection of numbers turns out to have only 13 degrees of freedom because it's flat set of points, started and finished flat. And the grids have exactly the same number of degrees of freedom. and that set of points is actually put down in the same locations as. The grid was from starting 7 to starting 14, and this is the starting 74. So.
You mean those points there?
Yeah, the points in the picture are, so to speak, the after image of this set. That's a theorem, that the information content of these is the same.
And those numbers, like 1.237.
That's a growth rate.
You call it a growth rate. Is it just the multiple by which you would get the same distance corresponding?
Oh, no, this is a longitudinal data set. So it is the average growth rate over those 18 rats along that segment for those 7 days.
The growth rate not being some sort of derivative on log scales or anything. The ratio of the final.
I see what you mean. No, this is all in the appropriate linear approximation. This is, in fact, the ratio of those measured distances between the points, and the distances on the grid correspond to it.
Okay.
Yeah. But yeah, if where the grid is bending,
it's kind of the ratio for the average points in the two in the before.
Yeah, where the grid is bending, these lines don't bend; they just contradict each other. The grid accommodates that by bending. And so this was partly an answer to tease you through it on Tuesday when I kept on showing you things that these analyses don't do. What they do is very nicely handle cases of smooth interstitial growth, which is what the rat skull is doing for most of its growth. Not the earliest embryogenesis, but everything after that is just mostly growing almost proportionately. And the directions here are going to turn out to be quite interesting, quite useful. But the other thing we can't do is just look at this picture and try to make biological sense by picking extremes here. And that's the example on the next page. What I did here was take that same rat octagon and just pick a couple of obvious ratios the way Rudolf Martin a century ago was picking obvious ratios. So here's height to width over those 8 different ages. Here I'm using log days. Each of these now is one animal at one age. And here's, so height to width.
Right, so we've got an octagon that looks kind of like this. And height to width is this kind of ratio. And this other one, Calvin to cranial base, is this kind of ratio. So this is a ratio of distances in parallel directions at a displacement. And this is a ratio of perpendicular distances. This is a language you're probably not used to, although it's not deep, it's elementary. My point is only from this projection that this kind of ratio, parallels, and this kind of ratio, perpendiculars, give you different descriptions of growth. Because this curve is a different S shape from that curve. This one flattens out almost perfectly. This one keeps on being steep. This one has a point of steepest descent here. This one doesn't. Lots of things are different about those curves. And you get into trouble quickly if you try to pick one of these over the other and say, that's the one I want to talk about. So on the whole, we need methods that are more general than just picking distances or picking ratios of distances or picking angles. And the beginning of that discussion applies when you have more than 2 points. For 2 points, there's only one distance. For 3 points, you've already got 3 distances and also 3 angles. Then it will turn out you have more than that, more choices than that. And the answer isn't to pick some of the distances and some of the angles. It's a different machinery. And at this point, we're starting to do geometric morphometrics very explicitly. What's surprising about this is that it did not appear until 1991.
1984 was the first publication of this in a journal. And that's 32 years ago. It was by me. But that's incredibly recent for a method this simple. The reason it's so recent is that nobody before that was asking this question in the statistical language I'm using. How do you select the distances? And in particular, from what space are you selecting the distances? And I'll give you a hint of the answer to that question if I can find an eraser. Oh, over here. The trick, it will turn out, is if this is the triangle you're talking about in some data set, the distances you care about aren't those three. Mm-hmm. The distances you care about are all of these, and all of these, and what am I missing? All of these. So we have one pencil of them going all the way around a semicircle. And the computation is going to pick exactly two of those red lines. And this is called the tensor description of shape change for a triangle. So we're not picking two out of the three sides. We're picking two out of this infinite number of possible transects. And we're picking them because they start and finish at 90 degrees. One of them will be the direction of greatest change of length, one the least. This is what came into morphometrics in 1984. The geologists had already been doing it for 150 years. No one had tried to bring it into morphometrics. Basically, they were just working with the distances. And as soon as you raise the issue of the fact that the biologist is free to select distances, things become a whole lot easier. I was just getting some ambient noise in my hearing aids. So let's see how this works. How do we start talking about patterns of distance? Patterns of choice of distance. Well, here you're slightly at a disadvantage because in the book this was done 100 pages earlier, but I'm trying to protect you from too early a water torture. We'll be doing this next Tuesday or maybe 2 weeks from then. But this is an application of the technique that Chapter 4 is saying is the fundamental maneuver of multivariate statistics, the singular value decomposition. And when we start looking at R, this will be one command in R that you write as SVD of something. That stands for singular value decomposition. I guess it's lowercase. Yes. So this is something that you're not responsible for programming yourself. It's already there. What we did in Chapter 4, and that's sitting on your class website, was take a matrix. In this case, it's 2x2, and write it in a standard form that chapter describes. And now let's do that as geometry instead. Here's a transformation of shape of something. This is a square on graph paper. This isn't. It's a parallelogram. Here are the coordinates of the corners of the square. Here are the coordinates of the corners of the parallelogram. And if you go back to the previous page, you see that those are, oops, I went too far. Those are actually the numbers in the matrix that the computer is talking about. Yeah, sorry, I didn't skip the page there.
Which numbers are those? That S there is which numbers?
Look at 1... 10, 5, 2, and 14, and then go out to this picture, and look at 10 and 5 and 2 and 14. So those rows of the matrix are the vectors of the sides of that parallelogram.
Okay, so it's from the 0, 0 up to 2, 14.
Yeah. So
I'm not right on the screen.
Not a good idea. Okay, so here's, I'll just multiply them by 10. So I've got 10, 5, 2, and 14. I've copied them from the vector to a matrix notation, and then for the moment, but probably not through Tuesday, I'm just doing something with that matrix.
And the fact that these figures
there's the matrix.
Are parallelograms means that the fourth point
it has no additional information.
Follows on from
right.
them.
Yeah, okay. We're about to get rid of the fourth point. But for now, for the purposes of this picture, for the analytic geometry, it's helpful to start with a square instead of a right triangle and so on. So, see, this is the item on this page. You can show that what you do when you take a singular value decomposition, so what the R software will let you do, is the following in that picture of the square and the parallelogram. It is going to find you a pair of directions that's perpendicular on both forms. So it's going to find you this pair of directions. If there's here's a set of directions on the square, a set of directions on the parallelogram. And now I'm doing something tricky. I'm implying a definition of what the same direction on the form is. I'm letting you see that this is something like the difference distance from here, about 80% up this edge, to here, which is about 20% the way up this edge, both in this form and in this form, where it's 80% of the way up this edge to 20% of the way up this edge. That'll turn out to be equivalent to the red thing on the blackboard. So these are homologous pairs of distance measurements. The singular value decomposition is just working with matrices, with things like that. And the theorem says you can always turn it into one of these, or one set of these pictures. A matrix like that, that starts from these two vectors, can be turned into the picture of two crosses. Furthermore, they start and finish it, they're perpendicular in both pictures. These are at 90 degrees in both pictures. Furthermore, if you were measuring all possible lengths, if you were doing the red thing there, this is the distance of greatest ratio of change of length, and this is the distance of least ratio of change of length of any possible pair of distances you might pick. You're getting a lot of information here from one simple matrix algebra theorem. And we'll go over this more on Tuesday. But I wanted to explain that it's the link between this language of measuring distances, which you do with a ruler, and this language of selecting distances that are worth measuring.
Could I...
Let me just one more sentence.
Yeah.
What makes it work is that I'm saying I'm not limiting my distances to the distances between the points. I'm also letting myself measure proportionals. 20% of the way down here, 20% of the way up here. Joe?
I think from the matrix algebra, it's immediate, but it's not so obvious just staring at these, that if you take the right-hand parallelogram and rotate it by 30 degrees, you still get the corresponding axes.
Yes.
Rotation...
It is kind of obvious here because I did that rotation in the course of...
Yeah, but the rotation, any rotation that you make of them just doesn't affect the axes right. rotate along with it and are the same axes.
Okay, that's cute because you're anticipating a point of about 5 pages further on. But
I thought
I'm
was
going
probably
to. I have complete freedom to rotate a triangle when I'm talking about distances, and I'm going to rotate it shamelessly to make the theorem easiest to see. And Joe is absolutely correct. I'm assuming that you are binocular primates, so you can turn your head and understand that the object is invariant. Or you can turn the object and understand that its form is invariant before you bite into it. And there are worlds in which that isn't true, and in those worlds, this kind of morphometrics doesn't work. This doesn't work on the surface of spheres in hyperspace, for instance. It doesn't really work on lettuce leaves because they have negative Gaussian curvature and so on. But this is the picture you want to keep in mind for little squares of graph paper. I'm assuring you there's a theorem that says you can always do this for a square and any other parallelogram. And if you don't want to use the theorem in its general form from chapter 4, the actual algebra of how to do this for just 2x2 matrices is here. It starts on page 44. This is the presentation of this from my first textbook of 1991. What I said was that there are multiple properties of those crosses. One is that they start and finish at 90 degrees. One is that one of them is the direction of greatest rate of change of length, the other is the least. If you want to do this using high school algebra, using just the quadratic formula, you start from the end there. You start by saying, I want the distances of the greatest and least changes of length, which is the maximization of this thing, and it's going to turn out that those directions start and finish at 90 degrees because this is the quadratic equation you get for them, and the roots of this quadratic have product minus 1, you might remember from high school, and directions whose tangents multiply to minus 1 are perpendicular. I had that in high school trig. How many of you have had high school trigonometry? They don't teach it anymore. Well, they do teach it. Okay, because they stopped teaching it in my high school. They put it back. Good. So you just understood what I said. The roots of this correspond to directions at 90 degrees, but the question I was asking was direction of greatest and least change of length. And so because we're solving for that, we actually get those changes of length. And one of them is 2/3. What are they?
Those are the slopes or something.
Slopes are in here somewhere. Those are the directions. The directions are 2/3 if slopes 2/3 and minus 3/2. Okay, so this was just showing you that you don't need the full power of matrix algebra. You don't need that SVD operator to do this. You can actually do it, in effect, on a hand calculator. Or if you're very careful with pencil and paper and you can do square roots in your head, you can do this with pencil and paper. But also, and this is where it again becomes even easier to see it as biology, you can do it in geometry class. You can do it with ruler and compass. Did you have something to say?
No, I'm scratching my head.
Oh, okay. Yeah, all right.
I realize it's a dangerous activity. Yeah.
Almost anything you can do with quadratic equations, you can do with a ruler and compass. So here's what turns out to be the same problem. I'm now starting with a pair of triangles. So it's 3 landmarks now, not a square. it's a pair of triangles in a specific position. Two of the corners are the same. Two of the vertices are the same. I'm calling them 0 and 1 because that's where we're going to put them on the graph when we start graphing.
Here's my eraser.
These are going to be called Buchstein coordinates when we're done. And I didn't name them. Somebody else named them. Okay, so for now, here are three landmarks for Form 1 and Form 2. The first two landmarks are in the same places. And the third landmark is moving from somewhere to somewhere else. So this looks like this triangle, this looks like this triangle. Then there's a construction that could have been done 2,000 years ago that gets those directions we were just talking about, the ones of the greatest and least change of length. And it's so simple that, again, it's absurd that this wasn't part of the statistical toolkit, the biometric toolkit, until 1986. So I'm going to be hammering this point a bit throughout my lectures. So much of what I'm teaching is elementary that it is weird that it wasn't available until long past my PhD. My PhD was 1977, and most of this stuff comes from the 20 years after that, instead of from the 100 years before that. So, I need to see colors to my pair. Let me get some resources. Okay, so what I'm about to do, show you, is what the text calls the circle construction for triangles. Remember, what I want is the pair of directions that are perpendicular, both before and after, both on this form and on this form. Okay, this is, I think the picture just calls them A and B. And I want them to be constructed as things like those red lines. I want them to take the form of a distance from one point to a linear combination of two others, to something halfway between two others, or 70% of the way from one to another, because that will turn out to be enough. It's more than just the size of the triangle, but it's certainly less than every possible distance measure you might make. So it's a space of distance measures. It turns out to be a non-Euclidean space, but never mind that for now. And here's how you get it. You take this pair of points, connect them with a line. That's what's going on here in the figure, and you have to follow the caption of this figure, which you got, to keep up with me. Take the perpendicular bisector, which is that. It's an accident that goes through there. And so this is a straight line. It hits the center, hits the baseline. This is called the baseline at a point we're calling C down here. Take a circle centered here that goes through both of these points. There's an old theorem that says this is at the same distance from A as from B. And so there will be a circle that does that. So it's coming around like that. Call these points C1 and C2 on the baseline extended. And then there's only one more step, which is draw those things. See, I've got the cap on. Draw those things, also using the dead end. So the distances we're talking about aren't the size of the triangle. They aren't the black lines. The distances connect the moving point to C1 and to C2. That's one set of purple lines, and do I have another color? No, I'm out of colors, so I'll just use purple again. Here's the other set of purple lines.
Could I just point out something that isn't although AB, the line AB on the figure you drew over there,
is horizontal.
Is you're making it horizontal, but it doesn't have to be.
I drew it right. I was just copying this.
So the line between them is not really necessarily parallel to the baseline.
And the
bisector coming down isn't hitting the baseline at 90 degrees necessarily.
The picture you want to use in more generality is sitting on page 55,
where I don't. That's dry. That isn't. Is that exactly horizontal? It shouldn't be. That's a bad choice of teaching. Here's the more general case. But there's. I'm not using that.
And now, Euclid knew that angles inscribed in a semicircle are right angles. That's a theorem from book one of a book published in 300 BC, or whatever published meant in those days, a book written in 300 BC. And we remember from five pages back, those are directions we want. The ones that start and finish at 90 degrees. All we have to do then is turn them into distances measured across the form. And the way to do that is to move this line so that it's inside the triangle, which is what's going on here. We move that purple thing until it looks like this. And we move this purple thing until it looks like this. And now we've got a pair of distances that's at 90 degrees because they're parallel in both forms. I'm running out of... You want to think of it this way. Think of it separately on the two triangles. Move one picture sideways. And one of these distances has the greatest ratio of change of length. It's this one. This one goes up by about 60%. And one of them has the least. It shortens very slightly.
I don't see from the two that you drew there, the C1 to B and the C2 to A, how you move them into the triangle.
Let me blow up the picture. There.
We're still in.
Let me just try to do it here. I needed this direction, that outbound dotted line, to be inside the triangle on A. So I have to move this end so it starts here, and then it goes up in this direction, which is that. So that line moved to here.
So it's the line C1 to A, but with an origin at zero?
I moved the C1 to B? I moved the C1 end to zero, and this is where it cuts the opposite side. This is where the moved one cuts the opposite side of the triangle now, about there.
So did you just, in this case, slide it over?
Rigidly,
you took those two beaded lines.
Right.
The two you're interested in are the ones that are crossing in the middle.
I'm interested in... I want to get to these as distance measures.
Yeah.
They have the same directions as those two inscribed triangles in the semicircle. And this is just Euclidean geometry. This is parallel to that. This is parallel to whichever one it is. These two are parallel to those two. So these two directions are parallel to those two sides... And these two directions are parallel to those two sides.
Oh, I see. Okay, so it is not the two that cross that you're originally moving.
Yeah, I'm moving them separately.
You're moving the two that end in A.
Mm-hmm. Right. And then the thing down here is the same.
I'm sorry, if I'm being obtuse and everyone else is seeing it. You're taking this as a line segment.
Mm-hmm.
and moving it until its base is at zero, mm-hmm. you what, have it changed its angle?
No, you're just moving it parallel to itself.
Okay, but you're not rotating it.
Correct.
Sliding it. Taking this one mm-hmm. and sliding it over so it's there.
And that gives me this pair. Yeah.
And okay. that you can do for the two ending at A, and then you can do the corresponding thing for the two ending at B.
Right.
Okay.
Now, here's the example we worked with the square and the parallelogram. Exactly the same construction. We started with, here's a right triangle because it was part of the square. Here's the same thing for the parallelogram. I now had to change the scale to get these to line up, but I'm just talking about distance ratios, so it's okay. And here are the same pairs of directions we had before.
And in real life, this is just done by a matrix algebra inside of a function.
Actually, in real life, I originally did this with circles. It occurred to me only later that if I was going to do it several million times, I should probably use matrix algebra. Yeah. But this was first done by hand. And I couldn't believe how simple it was.
For the square and the parallelogram, you have to align.
Here, sorry.
For the second example,
you have to
align both up and down. You have to scale the parallelogram.
Here's I picked from the square. I picked these three corners. Mm-hmm. There's a fourth one here I'm not using, and these are the same. These are the corresponding three corners of the parallelogram. For the parallelogram, this angle isn't 90 degrees, and for the square it is. So it looks like I've tilted it a bit, and this now isn't a horizontal line anymore.
But it's just three. Those are just three of the points in the square. And
yeah, but because it's square to parallelogram, it doesn't matter which three. Now we are all ready to do data analysis. And there are just a few tricks that are worth mentioning. One is that it's sort of nice to have a picture about what it is that you did to line up those points 0 and 1. And this is the picture on page 52. So if this is one set of three landmarks, this is another set of three landmarks, you changed the scale and you rotated the second picture. And you translated the second picture so that both endpoints of your chosen edge lined up in the same places between the triangles. Then it turns out you can prove that it doesn't matter which pair of points you chose to do that from. You will always get the same answer, but it's always worth checking. Notice I listed three things you had to do. You changed position, you changed scale, and you changed orientation, you rotated. Those will be the same three things as in the Procrustes method, which will use different amounts of the three. This isn't a Procrustes fit. It isn't centering the way Procrustes does. It isn't scaling the way Procrustes does. It isn't rotating the way Procrustes does. But it's getting the same answer as a part of the Procrustes system. It's a much simpler to explain than the full Procrustes system, which is chapter 5.3. And that comes after the break. But this is the way this part usually taught. Pick up one edge, put it down exactly on top of the same edge in every other form, and here there are only two forms, so we get 2 points. And if you've got a whole bunch of forms, you get a whole bunch of points. Here's a whole bunch of sets of triangles, A, B, and C. And down here, I put all of the A's and all of the B's in the same place, and here's the scatter of C's. I've numbered one of the forms one of the 20. And over here, I put all of the C's and all of the A's in the same place, and here's the scatter of B's. And that doesn't really look the same, but in terms of complex numbers, one of them is a conformal transfer. It's a linear fractional transformation of the other. This really is the same information between these two versions of the triangle. I've picked different baselines, and I get exactly the same analysis. That's if I use all of the curving information. If I'm using linear approximations, which we'll get to in about one more page, then you usually pick the baseline that's longest, because everything here is a function of 1 divided by the length of the baseline.
Now, you are at the risk of, well, at various risks. You are showing us one way that one can do this.
Well, this is equivalent to any other way of analyzing a triangle.
Yeah, because you have so few points.
Yeah, because you have so few degrees of freedom.
But it remains to be seen for the moment why this might be an optimal way of doing it.
Well, actually, it's not optimal. It's just equivalent to all of the others.
Okay, so you're presenting people with one way that you could choose a description of how the shape of these triangles is changing.
And we'll finish today, we've got time, with 2 examples of where this appears to give you a useful description of a biological phenomenon. It's not claimed to be optimal, it's claimed to be biological. And that's already a refreshing difference from most statistics. Most statistical methods like the linear regressions we were talking about two weeks ago, those were optimal. Nobody said they were comprehensible, only that they were optimal. This isn't claimed to be optimal, it's claimed to be comprehensible. The other change that I was talking about is that for realistically small amounts of variation, like this, you don't actually need the semicircle. It's enough to kind of put a line through your data, if you have a line, if they lie in a line. Take the perpendicular to that line through the baseline. This becomes your point C, and then bisect these angles. And that's the same as the circle construction in the limit where those points A and B are close together. And this is, again, a theorem, but it's a very simple one. So, and we finally, one more approximation before we get started. There are some useful special cases here that are the subject of 2 whole pages in my first book. Let's see. If the line of variation is perpendicular to the baseline, the distances that you end up with are the height and the base of the triangle, the altitude and the base length. If it's horizontal, the way we were doing in this example in color over there, it's pretty much the 45-degree lines. If it's along that circle, semicircle through the baseline, then the distances you want are the sides of the triangle. Sometimes they're the right answer. These are optimal in the sense of their geometry. One's the largest ratio, one's the smallest. These are useful because biologically sometimes they do things for you. And as I said, there are 2 examples coming. One of which is for the rat skulls, and you can turn to page 61, which I can't find the page numbers on, so here we go. 4 more, please. Okay, so here's what I'm doing now. I'm in the rats. You've already seen them. And I'm taking just the set from age 7 to age 14, where we found the grid really looked pretty simple, but the distance ratios were all over the place, literally. And I'm applying this construction to a pair of baselines. Now, I can actually see what's going on there. Let me make that a little bit bigger. There we go. Okay, so there are 18 rats, remember? So here are, on this baseline, 18 changes from age 7 to 14 days, reduced as if this distance didn't change. So all the rats are put down on this line. And this is noisy because these are real living creatures, so it's good if we take the averages. Average of the younger rats, black dots, average of the older rats, open circles. And in this kind of analysis,
the model of always having the same triangle, always having the same directions, is true to the extent that these little vectors here of displacement are parallel to each other and proportional to distance from the baseline. And that's a pretty good guess here. There's a bit of notching down here, but these are mostly going farther from the baseline, kind of vertically, going farther from the baseline, kind of vertically. Baseline 1 and baseline 2 will be, which line is it now? Baseline 2 is that one. That's this set over here. And the phenomenon...
So, wait, the one on the right is has been rotated and...
Yeah, the baseline was put down horizontally.
That other baseline is now being used. Okay.
Yeah, so here's the sharp point. This landmark is this landmark. And part of what's going on here morphometrically is our descriptions are assuming that it makes sense just to throw these forms around this way. You say to yourself, what about gravity? You can't pick up a horse and throw it around. And that's true. We're assuming that our descriptions can be rotationally invariant, that it makes sense to rotate the form. This is true for some kinds of biology, like growth of skulls, and not that true for other kinds of biology, like trotting horses, for which front, forward, and backward mean something, left and right mean relatively little, and up and down mean a great deal because of the price of potential energy. So what we've got here is an analysis where the different baselines don't make much difference, and we have a word coming, it'll be in a couple more scattered dots before we get there. We have a word coming that this is a uniform transformation, nearly. It will turn out it's 80% uniform, 83% I think the figure was in the slide we had. 100 pages further on. So you can talk about the kinds of shape change patterns that are as if you had one big triangle of landmarks, so that all you'd need would be one such pair of distances, and you get almost all the information. And that's the case for these rats from age 7 to 14 days. Biologically, it's because the brain is growing, it's growing directionally, and that's all that's going on to determine the shape of the brain case. The brain case here is passive, merely accommodating neurometric growth. Let's take an example that's surprising because it's almost as simple, even though it's not as homogeneous. I'm taking now a whole skull. And I think I showed some figures from this analysis before. These are the landmarks from that picture that we had very early in the chapter of, it's on page 452, so I'd have to jump back and try to remember where I am here. Yeah. Okay, so this picture coming is of these landmarks, but not the semi-landmarks between. Not the dots, just the stuff with letters on them. For 22 human Homo sapiens forms, of which, if I'm remembering right, 6 are children, infants, and 16 are adults. It's a terrible sample as these things go, but it's from a museum and it's very convenient. So now back to page 452, I think we were. Here we go, yeah. So I've turned it into a two-group comparison. Babies to grown-ups, 6 to 16, and I'm selecting the baselines to make the description as plausible as possible to the biologist, in this case it would be an anthropologist or a craniofacial or an orthodontist, who wants to interpret something like this. So here's a possible baseline. It's taken from the outside of the form. It's from here to here. Watch, you see my two fingers. These are the top, from the top of the skull to the back of the skull. And this is arbitrary. But if you look at these shape phenomena, you see that, well, with some exceptions here, it looks as if those are kind of parallel to each other and kind of proportional to the displacement from the baseline. So this is kind of uniform. And it turned, I forgot, let me try to remember now what the number is. I didn't write it down here. It's in a later slide. But this has turned out to be about 80% uniform. And if what you want to do is explain in general principles what is happening to the growth allometry of the human skull and why this is usually described as a heterochrony, this isn't a bad start for the points. In about 100 pages, we'll get the grids, which will finally do this example right. But part of what's going on here in this part of the course is I'm showing you many, many different statistical diagrams, all of which have the same information, all of which are applied to the same points, and you, the biologist, are encouraged to choose which of these make the best story for you, give you the best slides, or the best poster, or the best dissertation chapter, from all of these versions that have the same information. Here, for instance, if this really was a uniform transformation, and it's close, the only thing I really have to worry about is the choice of baseline. And if I switch from that baseline to this baseline, I suddenly get one of those situations that was in the last figure we were talking about in the theory section. It now looks like the jaw, tip of the jaw, is growing away from this baseline. The face, the mandible is growing forward to this representation of the posterior structures. This is called prognathism. It's a phenomenon that you see a lot more in the anthropoids and even more in the monkeys, the primates generally. It pushes the snout forward. And so what we have for humans is a pattern of pushing the snout forward. It just doesn't go that far forward. We're very short-faced. Remember the facial angle business. So if you're doing anthropology or evolutionary biology or putting characters onto a phylogeny, and you just settle for the fact that we are a neotenous primate, then this is the right picture. And you say, but this point, external inion, is doing something different. It's the insertion of this muscle that keeps the head up vertically, and it's way thicker in adults than proportionate to growth from the infant. We will come back, as we do this example over and over and over, to exactly these same descriptors in many, 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 many different, fundamentally different kinds of pictures. So we'll be doing the rat data 5 different times, and we'll be doing this data 4 different times, always the same data, always different pictures, different biological languages. This will end up being, to a great extent, one of the models for simplicity of description that we want. In a baseline representation, it's all of these lines parallel to one another, proportional to distance from the baseline. On a grid, it's a uniform grid, one where every little square of the grid does the same thing, turns into the same little parallelogram. These are the uniform transformations, and they're going to be useful because you see them a lot. That's basically the answer to Joe's challenge. This description is optimal mathematically for the uniform transformations. There's no reason to assume that any particular transformation is uniform, but these almost are, the two I just showed you, rats 7 to 14 and the growth of the human. even rats 7 to 150 days aren't uniform anymore. We need more tools. Humans don't grow to the age of 1,000, except Methuselah. So this is enough growth to describe everything we want to know about humans, human skulls, in the mid-sagittal section, without the teeth, without the lower jaw. This isn't enough to cover more general processes of growth or selection. But this is a real process, and we've shown one useful, real picture that's basically about directions on a triangle of landmarks. Here's Regma, here's Inyan, this is Prostheon, the tip of the maxilla, and here are our distances. This one grows slowest, it's the size of the brain. This one grows fastest, it's the length of the upper jaw, prognathism. You don't finish one of these analyses until you have put the biological words back on. The statistician is not in control of this. The biologist is in control of this. The statistician does the typing, writes down the formulas. The biologist picks the formulas that make sense to be turned into words and sentences for the particular data set. I will repeat that sermon for the rest of my life, but certainly for the rest of this course.
Let me, before we break, just make an obvious point here, which I think perhaps everybody sees, that because you've chosen a baseline and then rescaled the skulls so that the baseline is the same length in both of them, if the juveniles and adults differed only in size, so the two forms where one is just a blow-up of the other,
nothing would show.
Then you'd have all those points wouldn't move. You just would have, each one would just sit where it is because they have been rescaled to get the baseline the same.
And that has a name. It's called isometric growth, and you get it in tuna fish, for instance, and other fish forms, swimming forms that are very strongly constrained by hydrodynamics. Will typically not change their shapes as they grow. Because if they did, they'd get eaten at one age or the other, or lose all their energy. So fish tend to grow isometrically because they have to swim. That's not true for land animals, usually. Thank God. Or we'd be out of job. Okay. Have a nice weekend. I'm here to answer questions until my voice goes, but you don't have to stay. And there's one more lecture from me coming, I think it's Tuesday.
Yeah, the scheme is a Tuesday Fred will lecture again. Then both of us, are away for two lectures, the second of which will be by Paul Sampson on his morphometric work.
Yep.
The first of which is this, we were desperate, so we scheduled you to have a discussion, a free-form discussion, and we'll ask next time for volunteers of somebody to lead it, and you can discuss until you decide there's no point and then just leave the room. But who knows, it might be useful. And I think when that's all over, I lecture for a couple of lectures, and then Fred comes back. So,
This is like tag team wrestling, except there isn't any trophy.